from Anaktuvik Pass to Quinnahock and communities in between. New innovations in sustainable northern housing are creating high-efficiency homes designed for Alaska conditions. What will village housing look like in the future? We'll talk with Jack Hebert about the new housing projects being constructed this fall, Mira Kohler with Alaska Village Electric Co-op's efforts at wind energy savings, and Senator Bill Willikowski regarding legislative movements toward helping Alaskans get there. And we'll take your calls, 1-800-478-8255 or 550-8422 on today's Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
Good morning. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for Steve Heimel today on Talk of Alaska. And it is today's Talk of Alaska, not the next Talk of Alaska. In the studio with me is Mira Kohler, who is the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, AVEC. Good morning, Mira.
Good morning, Lori. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's so good to have you in the studio. It's really nice to see you. And hopefully we'll be joined on the phones here shortly by Jack Hebert, who is the president and CEO and founding chair of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. And we're having a little bit of phone difficulty, but hoping that will get resolved shortly, and we'll get Jack on to talk about some of the projects that are going on around the state currently with some innovations in housing design. So Mira, let's talk a little bit about AVEC and what's going on right now. With, you've got wind projects in Chivac, Makoriak, Gamble, Quinnahock. Where are these projects currently? Are they completed or are they still in development stages?
Well, we have about 12 projects that are currently underway, most of which are completed. By the end of the next construction season, which would be September, October of 2011, we will have 34 wind turbines up and operating in about a dozen villages and serving an additional three villages as we connect villages together. We've got a pretty exciting project being built right now in Imonik, where we are going to be building a transmission line to connect Alakanuk and Imonik, and then we'll have four wind turbines in Imonik. So we expect those to make a pretty significant difference in the amount of diesel fuel used in both communities. So we, you know, our plan is eventually, over the next 10 years or so, to displace about a quarter of all the diesel fuel that we currently use with wind or other alternative technologies.
Tell us about some of the challenges. I was looking at your website and at some of the pictures of what you're dealing with in these communities, a wide range of course, weather conditions when you're trying to put things in or maintain them. How difficult has it been to put these systems in?
Well, we've been at it really since 2000. Our first project was a joint project in Wales with Kotzebue Electric when we put in two small 65 kilowatt wind turbines there. The turbines are actually owned by Wales, by Kotzebue, and we work with them to bring that wind energy into the community. It's been a challenged project because the turbines have not been very well functioning. Since then, our next project was in 2003, and then since 2006, we've been building projects 2 to 3 a year. So we're making really good progress there. And as time has worn on, we've become a lot more expert. The biggest issues that we deal with really are the foundations of the wind turbines, because since you have a rotating mass at the top of a tall tower, you have to have a really firm connection with the ground in order for them not to to experience a lot of vibration. So that's been the key issue. And over the last few years, we've developed some pretty innovative foundation approaches that have actually won us some fairly significant national and statewide awards for innovation. And it's starting to become a lot easier. Each one that we do is a little bit easier than the last one, but the costs are high. So in rural Alaska, typically, we're looking at something in the order of $1 million for a 100 kilowatt wind turbine. So about $10,000 a kilowatt. And if you look at that comparatively to costs experienced in the lower 48, it's more like $2,500 to $3,000 a kilowatt down there. And in fact, the Kodiak project, which is the large 1.5 megawatt wind turbines, I think they came in around $3,000 to $3,500 a kilowatt. So the difference is in the complexity of building in rural Alaska.
How long will it take to recover costs at that rate?
Well, we design systems. We won't build a system if it's not going to recover full costs within 15 years. We figure a wind turbine has about a 20 to 25 year life. And so we want to be able to recover costs during that lifetime. Of course, what's made it feasible to do is that there's been a lot of grant funds that have been available, and that's made a huge difference for us. The Denali Commission was one of the first ones to basically put their might behind building wind turbines, and so they offset about three-quarters of the cost of building one of those wind turbines. But even if the grant didn't exist, the wind turbines would still pay for themselves over the long haul. Our objective has been to try and reduce the cost of energy in rural Alaska, and the only way you can do that is to put all the benefit of the wind directly into that village.
Now, when you say they have a 20 to 25-year life cycle, is that obviously the tower's still okay, and so are you just replacing parts at that point, and then you're kind of set back again another so many years to recover those costs, or what are you looking at?
You're absolutely right. The tower and the foundation should be good for a much longer time than 20 to 25 years. It would be the nacelle itself, the moving equipment, that you would have to substantially replace probably every 20 years or so. We don't really know, because the wind turbines that we're using have really been only been in service for the last 7 or 8 years. But the projection is, based upon what we've seen in the life cycle of wind turbines in the lower 48, when you think about the wind turbine farms that were built in the 80s in California and so forth, those continue to last, and those machines can actually be refurbished and put back into use in other places. They're just too small for where they're at now. There are so much bigger machines that are now available. But some of those machines are now being refurbished and put into service in places in Alaska and elsewhere in the world.
Wind power in Alaska really isn't new. It was experimented with in the past and didn't have great success because of, I think it was a lot of unforeseen things such as extreme icing and the just the climate, the brutal climate in many places in Alaska. What do you know about those past experiments, and how has the technology changed to kind of meet those demands in Alaska?
Well, you're absolutely right. In the early 80s, there was a whole rash of wind turbines that were installed across the state and across the country because there was some major tax incentives that were offered to build renewable energy, because that was right after the big oil crisis of the early 80s and so forth. But those turbines were really not designed for Alaska. We did not have systems at that time to properly measure the wind, so they weren't placed in the best places. What has changed since then is that we've developed very sophisticated wind monitoring technology. We will not build or install a wind turbine in a place where we don't have at least one full year with two winters on either end of monitoring data, because that tells us what the quality of the wind is that we're going to be dealing with. And then we can account for things like turbulence and icing and so forth. We've had situations where we put up MET towers, as we call them, meteorological towers, in communities where they literally have iced up and fallen over. So we know that's not a good place to put a wind turbine. So we just go and measure in another spot. So you now have those measuring options available to you so that you're making the right decision the first time, not the second or third time.
And I imagine that the cost has, as you've gotten more efficient at putting up the towers and have developed these innovations, how has that been reflected in cost savings?
If we're talking about construction costs, we're seeing that construction costs are starting to trickle down a little bit, not dramatically, because you still have a very significant cost associated with transportation of the material, with building the foundation base offsite, bringing that in. That's not going to change dramatically. We can only hope that we can incrementally reduce the cost of additional wind turbines. For example, the project that we're building in Emonik this next winter, we figure that if we were to add an additional turbine could be added for about $800,000, as opposed to $1 million for the first four. So that's where we see the savings. When you're in a good wind regime, it quickly pays for itself.
All right. Well, thank you, Mira. Mira Kohler is one of our guests today on Talk of Alaska. We're talking about all things energy today. And hooray, the phone issue has been resolved. And we have Jack Hebert, president and CEO of the Cold Climate Research Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, on the line with us. And I want to let callers know that you can join our conversation if you have questions or comments. If you're out of the Anchorage area, the number is 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. And if you're calling in the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also send us email, talk@aprn.org. So let's get Jack on with us now and talk a little bit about their housing innovations. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Lori. I was really enjoying listening to both of you. So I guess now I get to participate, but it was very, very interesting hearing what Mira was talking about.
Well, we'll get back into some of that also, but I'd really like to have you tell us a little bit about the projects that you have going on. You've got a home that you're going to be building. It's my understanding the materials are being delivered now for the Quinnahock project, and there's a home that was built last year in Anaktuvuk Pass. Tell us a little bit about these two, how they're different and how they're the same. What's going on with these houses?
Well, we actually are in the midst of building the Quinnahock home now. We've got a couple of our instructors up there, and I'll be up there next week working with the village. The similarity is really in the process, Lori. And the process is working with people in a community to design a home that is energy efficient and affordable, of course, but also that reflects the culture and the lifestyle of that region and the people that live there.
Well, that's something that interests me too, is bringing in that cultural component. And as you describe the homes, tell us how that works and how you came about developing that in the philosophy and the strategy for these homes.
Well, really, a village home is a custom home. And each village is a custom project, and each individual and culture and their needs is a custom project. So it's not dissimilar to what a custom home builders and home builders have done traditionally everywhere. You ask your clients, you ask the folks that are going to be living in this house what will work for them. And that just wasn't done in rural Alaska so much, but it's certainly not a unique approach. I think maybe just something unusual or something we're not used to seeing being done in a rural setting here.
And tell us about the home in Anaktuvuk Pass. That was built last year, is that right?
Yes, we built that last summer. Now, that was on the invitation of the village and TNHA, which is the housing authority out of Barrow that's involved in part of some of the housing that's being built in the villages on the north, actually much of it. And we were invited to Anaktuvuk Pass. This program, which we call Sustainable Northern Shelter, was a program that we developed and were very anxious to initiate a first project. And Anaktuvuk, as it turns out, was the village that was slated for a new home to be built, and the housing authority in the North Slope, TNHA, was interested in working with us. And then the people of Anaktuvuk Pass, probably the most important players in this process, were very interested in what we were proposing. So we introduced ourselves to the village and talked to them about what their needs were over a series of visits. And then we proposed to them a concept from what we were hearing and modified that concept with their input. So they were very much part of the design team. Now, we had some huge challenges, and I think most of the listeners are aware of the challenges we're facing in rural Alaska on transportation and cost and energy efficiency. So those were the pieces that we focused on from a building technology side. From an architectural side, what we focused on was what the ultimate family that was going to be living in this house, what their needs were going to be, how many bedrooms, what kind of space, what kind of spaces would complement their subsistence lifestyle and their need to store food. How would we address water and wastewater? How would we address renewable energy forms as well as good indoor air quality? A lot of elements were worked through in this house, and this was the prototype. Initially, we were going to build this prototype at Tulik Station on the North Slope, which is a field station that the University of Alaska owns and operates on the North Slope of the Brooks Range. The people of Anaktuvik, though, insisted that they were ready for this house, that they wanted to have the prototype in their village, that they would much rather see a family in it than scientists in it. So that said, we designed this house to be very, very assembled very quickly and simply. We engaged the Ilisavik College in Barrow to work with us and to train the people of Anaktuvik Pass and folks in the trades on how to build this home. The target was to build the home in 3 weeks. The target was to have the home be light and very compact for transportation, that we could bring it in on one DC-6. The target was to lower the cost of housing in that community, estimates of housing that were being done in that community, by at least 50%, and to have a very, very demonstration of what very efficient energy technologies could be incorporated and how can we keep the cost of actually living in the house very low. So it was an extremely exciting project. It was the first of an effort that's a statewide effort that's expanding now. But the Anaktuvik House, I think all involved feel it was a great success on a number of levels, Lori.
Is there a goal? Do you have a goal in mind for where you're driving toward? You mentioned 50% savings. Are you looking for a number, 80%, or are you just striving to make them better and that's the goal?
We have a goal of lowering the cost as much as possible. Ultimately, that's going to depend on a number of factors. Who builds it is one factor. If you're working with a housing authority and you're working with federal money and the regulations and the things that are involved in all of that, that's one level. If you're talking about an owner-builder building a home using this kind of design and this kind of technology, obviously that's a much lower cost. And we need to look at a variety of structures, just as we do in our urban areas. One person can afford one kind of home, and a person can afford a very different home. So I think the important thing is to demonstrate what is possible. Now, in the case of Anaktuvik Pass, we were working with a housing authority. We were working with federal dollars, so this was a Davis-Bacon wage approach. We were using fairly unskilled labor, and we did reduce the cost of the house tremendously. We brought it down from, above $500,000 home into a home that was in the $200,000 range, according to the figures that TNHA has given us. So we lowered it considerably. I think one of the most remarkable things is the amount of fuel and the energy use that we've lowered on the house, which is, of course, our job on the demand side to lower that energy use. And this house used 87 gallons of fuel oil from last November until the end of April this year. That's for the whole winter and a cold winter. While at the same time, we were able to maintain healthy indoor air quality. This house is very, very extensively monitored, so we actually know what's going on with the family that's living in it. We were also able to treat all the black water and sewage that was being produced by the family in a on-site sewage treatment plant at much reduced cost from very complicated infrastructure. So this house was a standalone home on wastewater treatment, And that, again, worked very, very well. The effluent coming out of the wastewater treatment plant was clean, literally potable water. We certainly wouldn't recommend people drink it, but it was very, very clean. We produced electricity from a renewable energy system that was part of another grant, which was a combination of solar voltaics and wind generation, and monitored that very closely. The electric demand in the house was very reduced using LEDs and very efficient fixtures and appliances. We were able to lower that. So the whole idea was to bring the operating costs down as well as construction costs. Now, this house took 4 weeks to build, not three. Our target was a $180,000 house, and this cost more like $220,000, this first one. But we feel that it was a success, and probably the biggest success for us is that the family that's living in it enjoys living in this house and are very proud and part of our effort, to make a success out of this. Very proud to be living in it.
Well, it's amazing just to hear that figure of 87 gallons for the entire winter. I'm sure that there's a lot of folks in rural Alaska who are saying, wow, sign me up. I'd love to have those sorts of savings with the fuel. And I want to remind listeners that you can call in possibly. We're still, I guess, we're having some phone problems, maybe not now. I guess they can call in. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or if you're in the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. We're going to take a call now and bring in Greg from Hoonah. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
So,
I live in Hoonah, and the city did a feasibility study on wind power here, and it was actually very good, but I don't know exactly why they didn't do it. But my business is right down where all the wind blows, and I just wondered if there's any state or federal grant programs. I've got a tower. I've got two of them, actually, but I just need a wind generator to put on it.
Well, I'm glad that you asked that question, Greg, because we're going to be bringing in Senator Bill Willikowski at 10:30. When we take a quick break, we'll bring Senator Willikowski on and ask him some questions about what's the legislature up to and how are they trying to help push legislation that can support Alaskans in some of these efforts. So hopefully we'll get you some answers for that question.
Okay. One other question is how... When you put up a wind generator, does it actually give you direct 110 or 220 power, or do you actually run an inverter or put it into a battery system? That's what I was going to do, is put it into a battery system and then make an inverter. But and there's one other thing too, and then I'll let you go. Is I heard that somebody invented some battery technology. And it's just like the carburetor for the gas engine years ago. And it was really cool battery technology. And one of the oil companies bought it up and actually says that we want to help you produce this, and actually went and shut that technology down. Now they own the patent and they won't release it. So it's just something to think about. So anyway, I'll listen for any comments off the air.
Thanks, Greg. We appreciate the call. And so Mira Kohler from AVEC, I'll ask you that question. Does the wind generation run right into 110? Does it go to batteries? And what is going on with battery storage? I know that was a big problem in the past where people couldn't store enough electricity because the batteries were so prohibitively expensive that you couldn't have enough to store for when the wind wasn't there. What's going on that front?
Well, those are really all very good questions. First off, the wind generator will generate electricity. It's DC electricity that it generates, and it does have to be inverted for AC technology, which is what we use, of course. And I do know that there are some small battery systems that are used and available for small-scale wind generation storage. But for the most part, it's use it or lose it. And typically what happens is you use the power. If you have any excess power, it flows over. You can sell it back on the grid to the electric utility. We're buying back power from Schachtulik, from a producer over there, as we speak, when they have excess energy. The battery storage issue is the number one issue that plagues renewable energy generation that is not steady generation. If it's intermittent, the issue becomes how do you store the excess power. What we do in our villages, obviously the amount of wind generation we put in is more than the average load in that community in many cases. And there's many times when there's more electricity being produced than can be used. And at that time, what we do is we divert the electricity into a sink load. And we essentially have electric water heaters that are on the system that absorb that excess electricity. And we locate those boilers in places where that heat can be used. So, for example, would go into a school system or into a water treatment plant or in some other way so that we beneficially use that electricity rather than just, you know, losing it entirely. But the challenge becomes that the diesel generators have to collaborate with the wind generation to get the best efficiency out of both the diesel generation and the wind generation. So it's a really tricky balancing act. And those are very good questions. Those are what we struggle with as we're trying to put in substantial quantities of wind into the system.
Well, and then the caller, Greg from Hoonah's, his last comment was hearing about some technology that was bought up by an oil company. I don't know if you've heard anything along those lines. It kind of reminds me of stories that we've heard in the past about the carburetor that could get, you know, 200 miles to the gallon and a car company bought it and hid the technology. And I don't know if you've heard anything about such technology being available and suddenly being spirited away.
And I don't know anything about that specific instance. I do know that I watched the movie Who Killed the Electric Car, and it was just a heart-wrencher. Here's this wonderful machine that's giving you just tremendous value in terms of miles per energy consumed, and it was essentially killed 25 years ago for reasons, obviously, that are to do with global competition. I do know, however, that there are some very, very good minds that are working very hard on the battery technology, and whether or not something has been developed that's been whisked away from the market, could be. I don't know about that. I do know that there's a research organization called the Cooperative Research Network that's affiliated with the electric cooperatives nationally, and battery storage is one of the key issues that they've been working very hard on for the last few years, and I expect that we'll see some affordable alternatives coming up in the foreseeable future.
Well, I want to ask, we're going to be taking a break here in just a moment and then bringing on Senator Bill Willikowski on the phone with us. But Jack Hebert with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, does your work encompass working on more efficient energy generation, or is your main focus just on the housing itself?
Well, they're integrated. We work on smaller integrated systems. The systems that AVEC typically works on are more community size or village size. We look at the home itself as having the ability to have small integrated systems. Those of you that have visited the Housing Research Center here in Fairbanks, we have what we call the HMEP, Hybrid Micro Energy Power System. And this system both heats and produces electricity for the building, for this particular building. In Anaktuvuk Pass, on that home, we have solar voltaics and we have a wind generator. Now, Mira brought up the issue of storage and using a thermal storage as a heat dump. And that, again, is something that we're experimenting with homes. In Anaktuvuk Pass, we found that with the wind data that we had and the generation that was being produced by the small wind generator, that just a slightly larger wind generator could have heated that house with a thermal dump, heating water, and then drawing off that water to heat the house when the wind wasn't blowing. So it's possible to do that. We're also working here in Fairbanks on, again, on a building size scale, on a school, where we're capturing heat in the summertime from solar hydronic. We're driving that heat into the ground and using the ground itself as a thermal storage bank, and then pulling that heat back off with a ground source heat pump in the wintertime, cooling the ground back down and then seasonally warming it back up. So yes, we are very involved in these systems that are integrated, but not on a village or community size, more on a small individual building size.
All right. Well, these are all exciting innovations and comments, and we're going to get back to this discussion in just a moment, and we'll be joined by Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski, and we'll talk a little bit about the legislative piece of what can happen, and we'll also take your calls when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
Good morning and welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and we're talking today about energy efficiency housing and fuel use, all things energy in Alaska. The numbers to call in are 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In the Anchorage area, you can reach us at 550-8422, 550-8422. Mira Kohler with Alaska Village Electric Co-op is in the studio with us. Jack Hebert from the Cold Climate Research Housing Research Center at UAF is on the phone. And also joining us now is Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. I know that you're kind of in between meetings and having to catch a plane, so we appreciate that you can come on and talk to us for a little bit. We're talking about the innovations in housing that the Cold Climate Housing Research Center is working on, and we've been talking with Mira about wind energy. And now it's time to find out what the legislature is doing to help us kind of get there. I know that there's some legislation that was signed recently by Governor Parnell, Senate Bill 220, the Alaska Sustainable Energy Act, and House Bill 306, establishing a statewide energy policy. Tell us a little bit about what these are striving to achieve.
Well, House Bill 306 is a general state policy, and one of the bigger things that we have in that policy is a requirement or goal for the state to have 50% of our energy produced by renewable energy by the year 2025. And it's a lofty goal. It's a high goal. Right now we're at about 25%, which is actually very high compared to virtually every other state in the country. But I think we can get there. We thought it was very important that we lay out what our goals are as a state. And we did that in House Bill 306. And then in Senate Bill 220, that's sort of the meat and potatoes, if you will. What are some ways that we start to get there? And some of the things that we did, for instance, were we required that the state retrofit 25% of all of its state buildings. They have to do an audit and figure out which ones are the most energy inefficient buildings. And then we've done this with about 8 or 10 state buildings already. The savings have been in the 30 to 40% return rate. So we've been extremely successful so far. And this bill required that we retrofit 25% of our buildings. We estimate that'll create probably hundreds of jobs through the retrofitting process, but also we'll save the state anywhere from $3 to $10 million per year once we get those buildings retrofitted. Another provision that we had in the bill was a provision to start a loan fund for commercial businesses so that they can retrofit those businesses. We have yet to capitalize that. We're hoping that this year, next year, we can do that. Another real critical piece that we did was we took $18 million of the federal stimulus money that was available to the state, and we used that as seed money to create a revolving loan fund, which they can use to create basically a $250 million loan fund. And that is money that will be available for local communities all across the state to retrofit, to weatherize their schools, their libraries, their public safety buildings, their community buildings. And we estimate that will create about 2,000 to 2,500 jobs all across the state and also save local communities tens of millions of dollars through the retrofitting process. If you can retrofit a building in rural Alaska where and have a savings of 30% or 40%, which is not uncommon at all, you can save hundreds of thousands of dollars just in that one building alone. So those are a couple of the provisions. We had another provision which will increase the amount of LIHEAP, which is low-income heating assistance, that's available for families in Alaska when the price of oil goes up. As the price of oil goes up, the amount of assistance goes up. We have this dichotomy here in Alaska where high oil prices, great for the Alaska Treasury, very hard on Alaska families and because their heating rates go up. So we tied it to the price of oil. So we think that'll help Alaskan families. Another thing that we did, a couple things that we did a few years ago, we created the Renewable Energy Fund, and we've funded that about $150 million. We also have put about $300 million towards weatherization and home energy rebate programs to help families go ahead and weatherize their homes, retrofit their homes. And I know I have many, many people that live in my area that have done that and have seen savings in the 20 to 40% range. So, and if it's still going on, if people are interested in doing that, they can still go ahead, contact HFC and sign up to do that.
And we had a call from a gentleman in Hoonah. Greg in Hoonah was calling to find out about getting money to tap into some wind energy there. Are there, you talked about a revolving loan fund for commercial entities, but I don't know if Greg is a business or if he's a homeowner and he's just looking to save some money. What's available for average Alaskans who aren't commercial folks?
Well, we do have the weatherization program, which is available for people at a certain income level. I think it's 100 or 150% of poverty level. You are eligible then to go and get your house weatherized. If you meet those requirements, you get a rater, and the state will pay a large chunk of the cost to weatherize your home. If you don't meet those requirements, then we have the home rebate program, which anyone in Alaska, any homeowner in Alaska, can apply for. And that's a great program. I'm actually doing it myself right now. I had my garage doors replaced the other day, and I'm already noticing a big difference. But one of the things that we heard was middle class people, they want to do the energy rebate program, but they can't afford the funds up front, which is what the law requires. We had we tried to put this in the law this past year to have loans for families to do the retrofits. We weren't able to get that passed. I know that's something that people are very interested in doing, and I expect that'll be a topic of conversation next year.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. 550-8422 is the number to call. You can also email us, talk@aprn.org. I'm going to get to an email here in a second. But Senator Wilikowski, so there's no funds available for the average citizen that wants to consider some sort of larger energy goal, such as putting up a wind turbine?
Not at this point. We don't have that. We did have a bill. Actually, it was part of our energy package to have renewable energy tax credits. Or credits that were available for people who went out and put in renewable energy projects. Unfortunately, that fell by the wayside. We couldn't get enough legislative support. I do, again, see that bill coming up again this coming year. We do have the Renewable Energy Fund, which I mentioned before. That's available for communities. But at this time, we don't have a provision to allow for direct funding, state grants or anything for individuals. What we did do in Senate Bill 220, just another provision, was we have allow local communities to provide property tax exemptions for renewable energy type of projects for households. And so that's one area. But again, that would have to be come from the local community in the form of a property tax break.
All right. I want to get back to Jack Hebert with the Cold Climate Research Center here in just a moment, and also Mira Kohler, our guest in studio, who is the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Co-op. But another question that I have for you, Senator Wilikowski, is the 50% goal for renewable electricity by 2025. Is that for state entities, state buildings, or are you looking to have 50% renewable electricity across the board for Alaskans?
That's 50% across the board. And it is an ambitious goal. It would be, I don't think any other state approaches that. In fact, I don't know that any other state has 25% right now. But if you look at other countries in the world, like Iceland, for instance, they have a huge, huge majority that is generated by renewable energy. We have communities in Alaska, for instance. Juneau is virtually 100% tied to hydro. Kodiak is virtually 100% through hydro and wind. And we want to see small projects all around rural Alaska so we can help those rural communities that desperately need assistance. One of the ways that we get there, sort of the biggest way you get there is by doing a major hydro project in South Central, either Chacachamna or Susitna Hydro, which would generate an enormous amount of energy for the entire rail belt. And so that's sort of the big whack that you can get to get close to 50%.
And so is there this 50%? It does sound like quite a project, especially for a state like Alaska that has so many different climate challenges and different things that we're dealing with weather-wise. What is there a program in place? Is there one being developed? Is it just a stated goal, or is there sort of a roadmap of how we're going to get there by 2025?
The 50% is the goal that was passed by the legislature in House Bill 306. The way we get there is what we're all exploring right now and have been exploring for the last year and a half. As I mentioned, of course we want to see as many renewable energy projects, low-cost energy projects in rural Alaska. In order to get to the 50%, you really need to do a major project here on the rail belt. And to put things in perspective, the rail belt uses at peak capacity about 800 to 900 megawatts of power. If you built Susitna Hydro, if you built it to its maximum capacity, you would generate 1,700 megawatts of power, which is twice as much as the power you need for the entire rail belt. If you built it to slightly lower standards, you could get 700, 800 megawatts pretty easily. Chacachamna, you can get about 300, 350 megawatts of power, which is almost 50% of the entire rail belt need right there. So one of those major projects, if they're built, will get us to the 50% goal pretty easily.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Wilikowski. I know you have a plane to catch, so if you have to leave, we understand. If you can hang with us, that's fine. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422. We're going to take another caller now. Brian is in Anchorage, but he has been to St. Paul Island and has a question about wind generation there.
Hello. Yes, I was out in St. Paul a couple of weeks ago, and they had three rather large wind turbines out there out at the airport. And the it was very windy out there, but none of the turbines were running. And I asked why they weren't going, and they said, well, if we run those, we lose our fuel subsidy, and we don't want to lose our fuel subsidy, so we just turn off the wind turbines. And that didn't make much sense to me, and I was wondering if anybody could explain that.
Mira, do you have any thoughts about that particular statement?
Well, St. Paul, of course, is a municipal utility, and I don't know an awful lot about them, but the three wind turbines were built by TDX, which is the local native corporation. I know that the first one that they built was built almost 10 years ago now, and that's a 225-kilowatt machine, and it is used to serve a small industrial complex that belongs to the village corporation and actually produces a very substantial amount of the total energy that they use there. They use it for both electricity and heat. The wind turbines are not connected to the community, so the community of St. Paul is not receiving any wind energy from those turbines. And I'm really not too sure why or what the situation is, but I believe there's a bit of an impasse between the city, which operates the utility, and TDX, which is the native corporation, I understand that there is a desire to put wind energy into the community, but they haven't been able to reach agreement on terms or conditions. So that's all I know about it. It has nothing to do with subsidies of any kind. I know that the community very much would like to have wind, but I think there's a little local politics involved.
Sounds like a story that APRN should examine, I guess.
Sounds like somebody should look into it.
Well, thank you for the call, Brian. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255 in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. 550-8422. We're talking about energy. And on the phone, we have Jack Hebert, who's the president of the Cold Climate Research Center, Housing Research Center at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And Jack, someone named Pam, sent an email to Talk of Alaska asking about hexagon homes, building hexagon type homes, and that she said that there's modular units. They are come in all sizes. They can be joined together, heat shared through contiguous walls, and that they're easy to move if they need to be moved. What do you know about this type of building, and is that something that's being used?
Well, we've looked at quite a bit of modular homes, different kinds. There's many manufacturers and some good products out there. What we try to do is promote local housing industry. So it's part of our philosophy that if it can be built affordably or at a comparable cost in a community rather than transported in, that helps the local economy, which is part of this whole focus on sustainability, that you also have sustainable economics. Now, a hexagon is a very, very good shape. And in fact, working with the people of Quinnahawk on the prototype home that we're in the process of constructing now, it is a hexagon. So hexagons do work well. The amount of wall area to floor area is very efficient with a hexagon. They also spill wind well. Part of it is aesthetics. In Quinnahawk, the Yupik people of that village really like that shape. It mimics a little more the traditional shape of the home that they were accustomed to traditionally. So yes, a hexagon's a good shape. Whether or not this manufacturer is appropriate for Alaska, I don't know, or could be adapted. These are things that we are looking at, and certainly we have members of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, industry members that are involved in modular homes and SIP panels and those kinds of things, and we certainly work with them.
All right. Well, thank you for that response. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about perhaps some of the pitfalls of trying to get into renewable energy. And one of the electric co-ops or one of the electric companies in the state has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection because of a project in geothermal. And we'll be talking about that when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about energy efficiency and renewables. 478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. Mira Kohler is in the studio with us, and she is the president of Alaska Village Electric Co-op. And there's about 56 members. Is that what you have?
53.
53 members station or stations. Listen to me. I'm in radio, not in electricity. You can tell.
I can tell.
Not member stations you don't have. You have member villages. But there's, of course, some risk involved with switching over from what's known and has been used for a long time, diesel heat generation, and switching to renewables, and balancing those costs with switching to renewables and experiencing, as you have talked about, some of the things that have happened, icing and tipping over towers, and obviously those are expenses that weren't factored into the initial cost. And now we know that the NACNEC Electric Association has filed for bankruptcy protection, and it's because of involvement in geothermal and unexpected costs. And what do you know about that, Mira? And talk a little bit about how you do balance those things.
Well, let's take the last question first. Yes, the cost of renewable energy or alternative energy sources is very high, and especially if you're looking at something like wind, which is an intermittent resource, you still have to have all your investment in diesel generation because that's the mainstay of your generation source. And so anything that's invested in an alternative energy is essentially additional investment that costs money that could very well cripple a utility over time. We have been successful because most of our funds have been grant funds, and so the actual member equity investment in the project is only somewhere between 10% and 20% of the final cost of the project. So yes, it's affordable. The situation in NACNEC is really, it's a very difficult one, and it's one that personally affects me because I was the general manager of NACNEC Electric Association before I came to Anchorage 12 years ago, almost 13 now, actually. And so it's very near and dear to my heart. As anybody that knows from, looking at the map of Alaska, NACNEC and King Salmon, which are the two primary communities served by NACNEC Electric Association, is situated in a very, very energy-rich zone. NACNEC Electric has been trying to develop geothermal energy and have, in fact, I think what happened was that they bought their own drill rig, which is a very ambitious venture for a small co-op that only has something like $8 or $9 million of total plant before they bought that drill rig. And they've been drilling their own wells, and they've not been getting a lot of support. So they have been basically on their own and making remarkable progress in my mind. And I'm very, very optimistic that that project is going to be just an absolute boon down the road for all of Bristol Bay. But it takes a huge amount of investment to get it going. And so for a tiny utility like NACNEC to try and fund a project like that, has basically put them in a very tenuous financial situation. And now you have a lot of creditors that are a little nervous about whether or not their debts are going to be able to be paid by NACNEC. And I think there was some pursuit that occurred, and NACNEC has taken the course. I don't think they had very many options of a Chapter 11 protection while they reorganize and figure out a way to come through this. I know that NACNEC has quite a large amount of federal grant money that's available for the wells that they're drilling. I don't know what percentage of the final cost it's going to be and what the additional costs are going to be. This is a very moving target right now, and I think they just declared bankruptcy last week, so we need to give them time to reorganize, and I'm really very worried that they may not be able to continue to develop the project, and I'm hoping that that is not the case and that everybody stands behind them and helps them to bring that project to reality because the region needs it desperately.
Well, it sounds like that would be a perfect first endeavor for this revolving loan fund, that perhaps they could be in line for some of those funds through the state to help them get back on solid ground and or drilling into hot ground so that they can get this heat plant going. We're going to take another call here. Margaret in Kotzebue wants to talk about the weatherization program. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm the chairperson for the Native Village of Kotzebue, And we, as you know, we've had the McDowell study, which shows rural Alaska, Kotzebue, has 60% higher cost of living than Anchorage. And so we had an energy summit a couple of years ago. We created a community energy task force. And so we helped elders in the Elders Day put together a little energy savings packet where we energized the elders' homes with a little plastic covering over the windows. We bought energy-efficient light bulbs. We put in insulators for their outlets. We did door...
ceiling.
Door weatherization.
Weather stripping?
Strips. Yes, and that worked very well. And we do that every year. But we also decided to help elders with other programs. And we're happy that the Denali Commission gave us a grant through KEA, Kotzebue Electric Association, where we're just now, as of yesterday, installed the first solar-powered hot water system here in Kotzebue. And we hope to save up to 30% of their electric costs. But because of the cost to install, we are only able to assist six homes that were identified as having the best southern exposure. But I also wanted to say real quickly, you know, the senator that was on the phone earlier regarding the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation home energy rebate program, that was a good program, although I'd like to have had them talk about, you know, if they really want to help the people that need the weatherization the most, in such as rural Alaska, there's no jobs and hardly any funding, that they should have looked at what he talked about, getting loans out to those who really need it, who can't afford it, or maybe talked about advancing to contractors so they can help those who really need it. But the other idea was is to create jobs to push maybe local businesses to help with this weatherization program.
Absolutely.
We did that at the Kotzebue IRA.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Margaret, for those comments. We have to wrap up now. The hour flew by really fast. There's a lot of things we didn't even get to, but that always seems to be the case. I want to say thank you so much to Mira Kohler, President and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Co-op, Jack Hebert, President of Cold Climate Housing Research Center at UAF, and Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski joining us by phone also. Our engineer is Dave Waldron on the phones, Pat Yak, Connie Huff, and moral support, Annie Feit. I'm Lori Townsend. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.